You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Go Wild. Now, if you guys haven't had the opportunity to check out the Go Wild app, you need to do so. It is an app that is dedicated to the outdoor enthusiast. Fishermen, hunters, outdoorsmen of all kinds can join this community and do it in relatively a stress-free environment. You know, unlike other social media apps that will censor your harvest shots or may not have your best interests in mind, Go Wild is designed by hunters and fishermen and outdoor enthusiasts by hunters and fishermen and outdoor enthusiasts. And the best way to do that is to go wherever you currently download your apps, search Go Wild, and you will find it. Or you can visit their website for more information, timetogowild.com.
Welcome to the Transition Wild Podcast, the home for those looking for expertise and inspiration on all things Western big game hunting. I'm your host, Adam Parr, and you're listening to episode number 27, where we talk with Garrett Rowe on his 2018 archery elk hunt. Hello, thanks for tuning in. This is the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network. We are coming at you live here at the Transition Wild Podcast. Hope you're having a great day. Hope you've been out hunting. Hope you're enjoying your time in the woods. And for myself, I'm a whitetail guy. I grew up in Michigan. So when October 1st rolls around, that's when I really start thinking about the whitetail woods. You know, I'll always have that as my roots, although I'm, you know, kind of geared more here for mule deer and elk here in Colorado. My heart will always be with whitetail, and I'll always go on a whitetail hunt every year, regardless of where I'm at. So, I've got a Nebraska whitetail hunt planned for public land. I'm still debating whether or not I want to go before or after the gun season. I just found out that the gun season starts November 10th and runs through the 18th, which is pretty early, and it's smack dab in the middle of the rut. And I wasn't planning on hunting Nebraska till later or mid-November. So I'm almost thinking after the gun season might be a little less pressure, but you know, you're definitely rolling the dice there with getting pounded by gun hunters for a week, plus the archery season before. So I got to make up my mind on that, when I'm going to go. In the meantime, I am getting prepped for a mule deer rifle hunt in Colorado. I won a 7mm Remington Magnum badass rifle, Browning, a couple years ago at a Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation banquet. I bought $100 worth of raffle tickets, threw them all into the bucket of these two 7mm, and ended up winning one of them in the raffle. It was pretty badass. I went out and bought a Vortex scope, got all the accessories, you know, the case, the shoulder strap, all that stuff, and I think I've shot it twice. It's still not sighted in. I still don't know what I'm doing. I'm not a rifle hunter, but this is actually forcing me into doing that. So I'm going to spend some time at the range this week, get everything dialed in, and move over to the dark side, so to speak. I can't kill anything with my bow, so I might as well switch over to be a gun hunter, right? It's the easy way. So it's what I've heard, I guess. I don't know, but just kidding. I'm not mocking all you rifle hunters out there. It's just different. It'll be fun. It'll be cool. Can't wait to get out there. So I'm prepping for that, and you know, we'll see how it goes. Be my first experience. Today we'll jump right into it. We've got Garrett Rowe. He's a returning guest on the podcast. He was actually one of my first guests I had on the show, and he's the owner of Heads Up Decoy, which is one of the sponsors of this podcast. And today we're talking about his 2018 archery elk hunt in Colorado, and kind of the preparation and the stories behind it, and, you know, getting it done on public land. He hunted in a draw unit, you know, took a number of points to draw this tag, but at the end of the day, you're still hunting public land, you're still dealing with pressure, and it's a really cool story. Anytime you're able to kill an elk with a bow, public land or private land, whether it's a cow, a spike, a 6-point bull. I mean, that's a trophy, and it's a real accomplishment. So today we're diving into that. Hope you guys are liking these kind of elk hunt recaps. I'll probably be done with elk for a little while. I'm probably going to jump into some different stuff, but you know, I hope you guys are enjoying this and it's getting you inspired to go out and do this on your own. So without further ado, let's get Garrett Rowe on the line. All right, on the line with us now, we have Garrett Rowe with Heads Up Decoy. How you doing today, Garrett?
I'm good, Adam. Thanks for calling, man.
Hey, anytime. It's always great talking with you, and good to catch up. I know we had a brief conversation last week about your elk hunt, and I was like, man, I need to get you on the show just to tell the tale of the whole season and what led up to the hunt. So I'm excited to dive into that.
Yeah, no problem. I'm excited to talk about it. I'm still pretty happy, still kind of bouncing around and feeling pretty good about myself. So
yeah, I bet you're on cloud nine. Have you kind of recovered? I mean, it's been a couple weeks since the kill, but have you fully recovered from trekking around the mountains for a couple weeks?
Yes, I binged eight like I usually do when I get home. Pretty much, if it's not nailed down to the countertop, I consume it, and so now and then I kind of put a, when I was out in the mountains by myself, I for that last week, you know, you got a little bit of time to think about stuff, and I told myself that when I got back I would continue to work out. And so I've been catching up for the last 3 weeks or so, and then tonight I was able to finally get back to the gym, and it felt good. So
well, you're a better man than me. After I got done with elk season, I've just sat around and eaten potato chips all the time. So I've been pretty lazy. You know what's weird is I trained for that marathon all summer, and uh-huh. I did a half marathon in August out here in Colorado, and it was pretty high elevation. It was like 8,000 feet from Ouray to Ridgeway, and I was training so good. I was eating good. I was, you know, being pretty active and healthy. And then after I got done with that, I was just like, I don't feel like doing anything. So I think it was bad. It was almost bad timing before elk season, because I was like, by the time it actually rolled around mid August, I was just like, I'm done. I'm tired of running.
Right. Yeah.
But, for sure. But you're still hitting the gym.
Running has never been my deal either. So running is kind of, I have to have an activity with running, and so it's just I can understand how you could get bored with that pretty fast.
Yeah, agreed. It's a lot easier when you can incorporate it with, you know, doing something fun or a sport or whatever. But yeah, running, mm-hmm. it was pretty monotonous, and by the time I got done, I was just like, I don't even feel like doing anything, let alone you know, running or training or doing all that. So yep. Well, that's good. What do you got going on right now? Are you getting prepped for whitetail season? I know we're kind of beginning October here, but what's those plans look like for this fall?
Well, so, you know, I'm Kansas resident, so and there's giant whitetails behind every tree, right?
And so, exactly.
So at least that's what everybody says. But no, I am I'm thinking about whitetail hunting for sure. And prepping for that, you know, I have trail cameras out and, you know, just a lot of stuff kind of throughout the summer that was kind of distracting me and keeping me from focusing on Kansas. You know, the elk hunt was one of them. And there are just some other personal stuff, you know, that life can always throw at you. So I'm almost kind of going in cold turkey for the whitetail hunting, but I know one will turn up that I'm interested in, or several. It's just a matter of me being able to get out. And yeah, I have my son is going to be 11, and he's starting to become a little bit more consistent with his shooting. So we're going to try to, you know, do what I can to get him one, or at least give him an opportunity to shoot one. So those are kind of the things. I think the main focus is trying to get him an opportunity to shoot a deer, and then, you know, whatever happens with me as the season rolls on, it'll be what it is. And but I'm sure I'll find one. I'm sure I'll have one or two exciting hunts, and hopefully before Thanksgiving, I'll be standing behind some antlers.
That's the dream, right? That's gotta be cool. Right. So is this going to be, Caleb's first season actually deer hunting, or did he go out the last couple of years, or what's that look like?
He's had a bow and he's shot, and we've kind of just dabbled in it a little bit, but, I'm not in a huge hurry for him to start shooting deer. I mean, he's got, you know, he's only 10, and you know, his effective range is 15 yards. I mean, 15 yards, he's really consistent. 20, he gets a little more inconsistent. And he has a really busy schedule. He plays football. We practice that 3 nights a week, and then we have a game on Saturday. So religion on Wednesday and homework every night. It's hard for him to find some time to practice as well. And so, but he's good enough to 15 yards. And probably 20. I mean, we practice a little bit more over, you know, he practices as much as he can. He'll get to 20. And I think we can get in, if we can get him to 20, I think we got a chance of shooting a deer. And that's kind of the goal. So
that's awesome. That's really cool. So we've had you on the show before, Garrett. And obviously, you're one of the sponsors of the podcast. But, you know, just for people that maybe had not tuned into that episode early on last year, and for people who kind of are unaware, give us a little rundown of Heads Up Decoy and what it's all about.
Yeah. So we're creeping up onto, our 10th year of existence, public existence. And it doesn't seem like it's been that long. It actually seems longer, but,
time flies when you're having fun, right?
Yes. Yeah. But yes, we have had, we've been around for a long time. I will say that we've been the first person or the first people, to ever kind of come up with a radical concept of decoying, animals. And I just wanted a mobile decoy that could be moved and handheld, and that can be, you know, ready on demand, lightweight, realistic, and something that I felt like was needed out in the market at the time, and it still is, and people get it, and we've been, a lot of people are successful with it, and we've continued to stay around. We're a small company. It'd be nice to be able to go all over, the United States and, show off our product, but you know, that takes a lot of time and money and those types of things. So most of our presence is online and through, our social media and blogs and a handful of people that we sponsor. I'm pretty much 100% do-it-yourselfer. I mean, everything I hunt, you know, is self-guided, whether it be a Western hunt in Colorado or Wyoming or Arizona or Kansas. It's all things that I've dreamed up, prepared for myself, and I get very minimal help, other than friends, you know?
Yeah. So, and that's huge.
That's Heads Up Decoy in itself. And the reason why we stick with that is because, I'm about as regular, I think, as a person can get. And if I go on canned hunts all over and show our product working in places that 95% of the people never get a chance to hunt, then it really doesn't do any good for me to be selling a product to somebody. I think it's kind of I'd be a little bit of a fraud. So I succeed and fail with just as much as the people that buy my product.
Yeah, it's awesome. And you know, when I first moved out to Colorado and I kind of started hunting states like Kansas and Eastern Colorado and these kind of open areas, it completely changed the game for me with whitetail hunting. And then I've, you know, kind of transferred into elk hunting as well. So it's very versatile, it's portable, it's lightweight. And, you know, you see this trend, right? Whether it's tree stand hunting or hunting from the ground. Everyone wants to be more mobile, you know, nowadays.
Yeah.
Everyone's looking for that, you know, a fresh shit, a fresh hunt, you know, getting into new areas, being lightweight as possible. And I think the decoys that you're making and putting out there really play into that whole trend. Do you see that as well?
Oh, for sure. And you know, there's no one way to use them. People ask me all the time, well, what's the best, you know, how do you use them, or what's the best case scenario, or can I use it like this, what should I do in this situation? And it's always a loaded question, because we've kind of invented new ways to shoot animals with these decoys, that weren't there prior to 2008 when I first kind of shot the first animal with it.
Yeah.
A concept of being seen is totally different for an archery hunter, for a bow hunter, than what you've been led to believe for the last thousands of years, you know, of where it's total, you know, stealth and unseen and not smelled. And, you know, obviously the smelling part will always stick, but I mean, now we're to a point where with the decoys, the point is to be seen, and it is to be aggressive, and it is to be mobile. And there's no one way to use our product, and there's no one scenario that's like 100%. There are some scenarios out there where the odds certainly go up. And then there's times when you think that there's absolutely no way this is going to work. And the next thing you know, this speck in the distance, which is a deer, you shoot him at 20 yards, you know, when you just like, well, I'm just going to try and see what happens. And the next thing you know, they're in your lap. So, yeah, our product, Adam, is really a lot dependent on the person that's using it, their creativity, their understanding of animal behavior, when to use it, when not to use it. So, and we're still figuring that out. I mean, even after 10 years, we have certain things we look for, but we're certainly not ever afraid to try it just to see what happens.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. And you have a bunch of different decoys, right? Pronghorn,
yep.
Turkey,
yep.
Elk, deer, all the above.
Yes. Mule deer, both, buck and doe, whitetail, buck and doe. And you know, we've got some new ideas that we'd like to try. So, you know, we'll see what happens, how much time I have to roll out some new stuff. You know, but it'll still be basically, the same concept and the same applications, just maybe, some different, you know, kind of, without getting too far in the weeds, you know, just might have a different look. So,
yeah. For sure. For sure. And yeah, for people listening, you can check out podcast number 2. It's actually the second episode I did of the Transition Wild podcast. So if you want to get a more in-depth understanding, heads up decoy, definitely check that out. And then we dive into a little bit of Western whitetail hunting as well and tactics revolving around that. But today we're talking elk in the mountains. Yeah. So you, tell us, set the stage for this, Garrett. You put in for a draw unit, correct, in Colorado that you put in, you know, points for, which a lot of people do, you know, especially with the point creep and, you know, just being able to get into a little bit better public lands. Talk to us a little bit about the preparation and, you know, kind of getting that tag and, you know, the years leading up to that.
Yeah, started 15 years ago when I started putting in points. A friend of mine went, I think he drew with I think he drew with like six or seven points, when I started putting in.
Oh, wow.
And I had like literally, you know, 1 point at that time. And so, as we know, Colorado has the dreaded point creep. And for me, I was always seemed to be one. I mean, it's just like a carrot literally on a stick. It was just out of,
you get to year 5 and now it takes 7.
Yeah. And, you know, and finally, you know, we were kind of doing the math, and off the statistics from the draw results from the year prior, and we thought, you know, I got a better than 50% chance to draw with the amount of points that I had. And so I didn't really think about much other than I just wanted to get this thing off my list. I wanted to get it done so I could move on with my life. So I applied for archery elk, the unit 76 in Colorado, and I drew. So I was really happy. There's a sense of pressure as well when you're a non-resident and it's taken you 15 years, you know, it's been a 15-year process. Some people, you know, obviously they're putting in, they've been in for 19 and or 20, and they decide, you know, I'm tired of chasing this other dream. I'm going with, you know, with this unit, which is why, you know, you end up getting that point creep. And so, you know, I drew it and I started, you know, kind of working out, and luckily locally, many people have hunted that unit, where I live, in this area that I live, and friends of mine. So, scouting really wasn't a big deal. I mean, we kind of, you know, these guys, I didn't put a ton of effort into it because, I had so many other people just basically say, this is where you need to go. And so we kind of had an idea of how we would navigate those places. Yes, we did go out there and have a look at them in August. When we pulled into the unit, we pulled in there at dark, in August, and a buddy of mine that went on the hunt with me and the scouting trip, he goes, well, you know, it was dark. And I was kind of disappointed. I said, man, I would really like to have pulled in here when it was light so I could see this place. And he goes, well, let me give you a quick little tour. On your right is this big ass mountain, and on your left is the Rio Grande River. And then we'd go a couple of miles down the highway towards Crete or whatever. And he goes, now on your right is another big ass mountain, and then on the left is the Rio Grande River. So it's kind of ongoing. And well, when you wake up in the morning and there's sunlight, you see that there's some pretty big ass mountains, and it's a pretty rugged and can be an intimidating unit. So we hit all of our spots, found elk. We're really optimistic, came home, ran, trained, lifted weights, shot, prayed. And then waited for, figured out when I was going to go and how, you know, the family was going to navigate while I was gone. So I don't know. I wasn't smart enough, and I don't know if people out there were smart enough to look at the season dates. Me, I didn't look at them. I just looked at my points and applied. Well, the season can't end any sooner than what it did this year.
Yeah, it started pretty early, or, you know, started, late August, yes. But early in the scheme of things as far as, you know, kicking off and then ended.
Yeah, and the last day was the 23rd. And I think from an elk standpoint, the later you can get it into September, probably for sure in draw units, you know, probably the better.
Oh yeah.
So here I am thinking, holy crap, man, the season. I mean, now that I had the tag and I was starting to pay attention to when I was going to be hunting, I was like, holy shit, the season is going to end the 23rd.
Coming up quick.
So, you know, we went out the 6th, which was a couple of days before the muzzleloader season started. I really didn't have, because I have a decoy, you know, I do rely on, you know, rutting activity. That certainly increases your odds to decoy in animals. And so I thought, well, the closer I can get to the time when elk are kind of doing elk stuff, the better it would be for me. So we didn't go out, anytime in August, and then, you know, that first week of September, we basically didn't hunt. And got out there the 6th, thinking that we would beat a few of the muzzleloaders that were out, you know, influx of muzzleloader hunters coming in. We'd have a nice little camp and have a place to ourselves, and life would be good. Well, we roll into camp, quote unquote, roll into the spot we were going to camp, and someone had already,
claim their territory.
Yes, claim their territory, and so we went to the next spot, then the next spot, then the next spot, and then we're like, okay, there's a two track that kind of goes into this little spot here. Let's make it a camp. And so that's what we did.
So were these spots that you'd already scouted during that August session where you came out? You kind of had like five or six different kind of places to go?
Yes, absolutely. And they were, and so our, and our camp was basically centrally located. And what it ended up turning out to be was just, you know, camps about every, you know, quarter mile. For quite a way. So the guy that hunted it and kind of got me interested in this unit many years ago had hunted it and been in the unit a few times after. He was shocked with the amount of people. And so what we ended up kind of and this was not a wilderness area, but you know, it's still rugged and not easy to get into. We were kind of just rehashing over after several days of some frustrating hunts and setups. And we kind of were like, you know, I wonder if, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, they had a really big burn in that area. And so a lot of that stuff is pretty tough to hunt. You know, the only thing that's growing up there now are aspens, and the aspens are like 2 or 3 inches apart, and they're 2 feet to 7 feet tall. Basically, you know, then, or it's nothing.
Yeah.
So that area right there, you know, in the aspens, and, you know, you wouldn't be able to hunt. And then being able to get around in the burn, you know, obviously you would, it wasn't like great cover because nothing was really growing. So we were thinking that because of all those acres that had burnt several years ago, it just kind of concentrated hunters more. And we weren't in a super rugged area. And so, and a lot of people aren't like spring chickens because they've been at this for a long time, just like me. You know, the last day of the hunt, I hunted with a guy that was 65 years old.
Yeah. You know? I would imagine that many years of points, you're talking about, you know, people that probably are not in their 20s, maybe 30s, you know, but it's going to take a while to accumulate those points for sure.
That's right. And this one really big camp that was just down the road from us, I mean, these guys were easily in their 60s, you know. So, you know, so the areas that used to basically be, you know, there weren't really a lot of people in when my friend hunted, now there was quite a few people. And we saw elk. They just were not really cooperating. And, you know, and then you throw in, you have archery hunters, and then you throw in muzzleloader hunters. You got a ton of, you got 160 archery hunters and 160 muzzleloader hunters. And so, you know, there was a fair amount of pressure. I mean, the only difference between an over-the-counter unit, in my opinion, and unit 76 was that we saw more elk. There was a lot of people, and there were just, we were seeing elk every day. At least we were seeing elk every day. You know, in an over-the-counter unit, sometimes that doesn't happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can go a couple days without even seeing something or just finding some good sign. So I can see where that's the difference. Yeah. You're still hunting public land. You're still dealing with the pressure. You just might have some better elk numbers and, you know, more access to them, I guess.
Yeah. And when I was kind of talking to my friends, I was like, you know, do we need to be in the wilderness? I mean, are we going to be spike camping this thing? And he goes, in my experience, we should be able to truck camp. You should not have to, you know, go 5 miles back somewhere to find elk. And I said, okay, sounds good. I believe you.
That makes it nice, honestly. I mean, yeah. You know, I'm all for doing, you know, backpack hunts, and it's a totally different style. But, you know, when you're grinding for a couple weeks or for a long duration, I mean, it gets tough out there for sure. And it takes a lot more planning. Sure. Yeah.
Yes. So we kind of bounced around quite a bit and tried to find new areas. We had a lot of good intel. I mean, everything that, you know, everyone that I talked to that gave me information or that I had when I went out there, there were elk at every place we went, for the most part. The places that we found, I mean, I almost shot an elk 45 minutes into the trip.
Wow.
And I'm glad that it didn't work out like that, but it did. I mean, I was close, and I was going to shoot these elk got bumped. We don't know by another hunter or what, but they come right into us, 30 of them. And there was a nice bull in the middle of this whole herd. And, you know, and then, you know, the mountain winds kind of, you know,
always
kept
get
him
you
from me. Yeah, they always get you. And so, but, you know, everywhere we went, we found elk. We also found people. So we had to navigate, you know, and that's not always a bad thing also. I mean, that's one thing I learned in Arizona is sometimes other hunters can help you because it forces you to go to another spot.
Yeah.
And so you just have to say, okay, don't get discouraged. And then I think the thing that was most discouraging is the fact that there wasn't a lot of bugling, you know, and you know, by hunting, it was dry and it was warm.
Yeah.
And so the activity, I felt like, for the most part, there wasn't really a lot. Even though we were finding elk and occasionally we'd get one to bugle, we sat up on I don't know how many different setups and tried to call in elk, and they literally would get up and go the other direction. And I'm not I'm a flatlander from Hays, Kansas, but I feel like I sound like an elk. And we tried everything. I mean, from just raking trees to just cow calling to just bugling to a combination of, and it got to the point where none of the calling stuff was working. And so we just decided that, okay, every time we hear a bugle, we'll find one. And when he bugles himself, we'll just move in and get closer and closer and closer. And that ended up to be kind of one of the hunts that I almost would have regretted looking back had I not ended up killing one. Because we were, you know, we had had a little bit of bugling activity and we were kind of, you know, above a herd. We felt like was bedded, but we didn't know where. Occasionally he would bugle and we'd just move up until until the activity picked up. And I'm not sure how other people hunt out there. But it's something I've noticed in Arizona, and what we noticed in this hunt is that it seemed like between 10 and 2, there was a fair amount of activity, but you had to be way out there to hear it and to know that it was going on. And I ended up stalking a herd that was on the move for about 400 or 500 yards, and finally I eventually caught it. And I almost gave up on it because I couldn't find a bull that I felt like I wanted to shoot at the time. And just as about the time I was going to stop following him, the herd bull bugled and I was closer than what I thought. And, so I located him and I wanted, there was a dead pine that I got around and he was digging his antlers into the ground and really raising hell, which is great. And that's when you can move in on him. And so I got to 30 yards and he's going to town on the ground and flinging grass and mud or dirt. It wasn't really mud. It was just dirt and grass.
Yep.
And to the left, I couldn't get a shot. And to the right, it was open except for a deadfall. And the deadfall was suspended off the ground about 3.5-4 feet. It's about 10 or 12 inch diameter deadfall. So it wasn't a small one. So as soon as he would turn to give me a shot, which is where his herd was, that deadfall was going to cover his vitals. So there was no, there was, I was like sitting here 30 yards from a great 6x6 with potentially no shot.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy how they can be that close? They're that big of an animal, but for some one reason or another, you just can't get the right, you know, lane, or you just can't get that opening you want. It's crazy.
Yeah. So as I was sitting here trying to figure out what my, what I was going to do, what I should do, I was weighing my options and I thought, well, you know what, if I got about a foot higher, I could lob one right over that deadfall and, you know, I could put my top, my 30 yard pin right on the top of the deadfall and he'd be 5 or 6, 7 yards behind, you know, the deadfall was 20, 25 and he'd be 30 or farther. I just put my pin on the top of that deadfall and, you know, or in
arc
the deadfall.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it would arc over it. And that's what I did in Arizona, was the exact same thing. And so I thought, okay, but I just need to get 1 foot higher. And, you know, in Colorado, taking one step up the mountain, you know, you can get elevation pretty fast in places.
Oh yeah.
And so, but the bad thing about it is I had to move laterally. And so he started digging his antlers again into the ground. And I thought, okay, here's my chance. So I took a step to my right and up, and he saw me. And we stared. Yeah, we stared down each other for about, you know, 35, 40 seconds or whatever. And then he shagged ass out of there by past the herd. And,
yeah.
And it was over. And yep. I was like, bad. I was like, that's the one I'm going to regret the most. And so there was numerous other times we got into herds. Again, just could not figure out a way to call one in to get one to respond like you wanted. I mean, we'd get one to bugle at us when we were trying to locate one. Sometimes it would be a cow call. Sometimes it would be a bugle. We, once we got into 100, 150 yards or whatever, got the wind right, we just couldn't, they just never seemed to do it for us, I guess.
What was your tactic kind of getting into these elk? I mean, were you getting in there before first light and setting up and glassing? Were you kind of getting on top of a ridge and kind of, you know, going that route or pushing up the mountains with the thermal in your face? Like, what was kind of your setup that you would go for in the morning?
Yeah, exactly the last one. We would... About the time we would hit these open meadows at the top of the mountain, that we, it would be first light.
Yeah.
Generally. Now, keep in mind, there were times when we rolled into a place, there was somebody already there going to where we wanted to hunt. So sometimes we were late to another, relocating. And so it got a little bit harder. You know, we still had to use the thermals up to a point. But I, you know, where I spent most of my time hunting, we were able to, you know, kind of go up to a spot and use the thermals coming down and locate elk. Either they were, we seen them with our naked eye, or we glassed them, or we heard them. And once, you know, then we would just obviously use the wind. We'd try to stay below them and move in on them and try to call them.
Yeah.
And then it seemed like they always were wanting to move down the mountain in the morning. And so, you know, we had to stay to the side. And then once we kind of lost, once, if we couldn't get around them or we couldn't call them in, then we had to wait for the thermals to start shifting back up.
Yeah.
And so a friend of mine always likes to hunt, you know, southerly east or southeast or southern types of slopes facing, because you get more consistent wind thermals during the day. And
oh, really?
Yeah, it's hot. Yes, it's hotter on those slopes, but we found that there were still plenty of places for these elk to find shade in it and cool spots. And we had fairly consistent thermals on, you know, for most of the time we were out there.
That makes total sense. That's interesting. I've never actually heard that before, but it makes total sense from the standpoint of, yeah, you know, the sun hitting it, you know, it makes a big difference. And then, you know, you get on some of those opposite sides and you got different drainages coming together. You got the shade and it can do some crazy things.
Yes. So we found that the ones that were north facing were a lot more inconsistent. And I noticed that in one area, there was tons of elk in there. It was a small area. We've seen an absolute giant, one of the biggest elk I've ever seen in my life. He had 30 cows with him. And he was just, I mean, that alone was almost worth the trip, seeing an elk that big. And the tragic thing about it is we were set up on him and 70 yards from his cows. And he was bugling. We didn't know it was him first thing in the morning because we bugled when we hit the basin and he hit us right back, and then kind of all hell broke loose. That was a good morning for bugling and elk. And we moved right in on his herd and he would not come down to challenge us. It was like, what the hell is going on? And eventually they, you know, we were on that north facing slope and we just had weird, he would bugle in his bed and we would kind of move closer. But then all of a sudden, you know, every once in a while, we just got too close with those inconsistent winds and they just, you know, they smelled us and he got out of there.
Yeah.
But yes. So I just had more luck predicting the wind on those east/southeast facing slopes. And that's ultimately what ended up, you know, helping me out when I, you know, killed my elk there towards the end. I went back home for a couple of days to kind of recharge. I think residents that are out there, they have the luxury of, you know, of being able to hunt for 2 or 3 days, maybe come home for 2 or 3 days when it's the action's bad or the conditions aren't as ideal and go back out. And, you know, for non-residents, a lot of times, you know, you know, here's my 10 days, like it or not, this is
yeah,
it. Or
you're going.
You know, your 7 days, you're going. And then you get, you know, your tail handed to you day after day. And
it's a grind.
Easy. It's easy. It is. It's easy. Elk hunting to me is not as physical as it is mental. It's, don't get me wrong, they're not easy hunts physically, but mentally, I think you have to be tougher mentally than physically, because your mind just can tell your body to do anything and it'll do it. And your mind can keep you positive even when things are really shitty. And to me, I think, you know, having that mental state that keeps you kind of ready to really be optimistic and able to get up in the morning, able to go up over the top of that ridge and able to look at this mountain and not feel insignificant and be able to say, I can get up this mountain. I can get up these slopes. I can get to the next ridge. You know, it's not going to kick my ass. I'm going to kick its ass.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, that mindset, you know, you'll be rewarded. And that's kind of really what so I went home for a couple of days to kind of recharge. The buddy of mine that was with me, he couldn't stay. He had to get back to work. And I really appreciated all of his time anyway. I mean, because, you know, he didn't have a tag, and he was doing whatever he could to help me out. And, you know, it was his own vacation, his time away from his family, you know, both my buddies. And so it was great to have him. I enjoyed hunting with him. You know, we just didn't get it done there that first, I guess, session that I was out there. And I was ready to come home. We'd had a couple of days of really, you know, some pretty tough luck with, you know, with elk, you know how it is, elk hunting. And so I came home and saw the family, slept in a nice bed, took a shower, you know, and
all the important things.
Yes. And that Monday of the last week, I got up at 5 in the morning and loaded up. I left my camp and rolled in there in the afternoon and grabbed my bow and put my clothes on and headed up the hill and started hunting again. And I thought, man, I'm going to really, you know, I'm excited to hunt by myself. I've never elk hunted by myself. Just, you know, like totally, like I've always had people at camp, or I've always had somebody with me. And so I was really excited to, you know, to kind of go and do this again. And there was definitely a lot less people when I came back out. So the amount of people that were there was definitely diminished. And
do you think that was because the muzzleloader season wrapped up by then?
Muzzleloader was done. Yep. Muzzleloader was done. And so it was just archery guys. And so, I mean, I was optimistic. And then, you know, after a couple of days, I was like, man, you hear an elk bugle. And, you know, when you're with a partner, inevitably you're going to point to the left and your partner's going to point to the right.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I missed having somebody the most. Like, where the hell did that come from?
Yep.
So then you're stuck there waiting for it to bugle again. And I don't always sit there and bugle just to bugle to see. I mean, I do it to locate them, but I always like to have them, you know, bugle on their own first so I can kind of move in. There's no reason to be bugling when you're a half mile away and then a quarter mile away and, you know, you just push them off.
Yeah.
So in that respect, I thought, man, you know, I really thought I would enjoy hunting by myself. And then I just decided that, you know, I just, you know, got to get it done. And elks were starting to do what I wanted them to do. There was one mountain that none of my friends had hunted before, but it was in the area that we had scouted other spots. And I just said, you know, I'm going to live and die on this mountain. I'm gonna hunt this mountain because there wasn't hardly anybody up there. I was seeing elk. They were bugling. I was comfortable hunting there. It wasn't extremely treacherous. So this is it.
Yep.
So I didn't call in my first bull until the Thursday of that week. And I called one into 7 yards and, you know, and that set up, and I was going to shoot him because it was getting to the point. It was just a raghorn. I was between him and a herd bull, and I didn't care which one came in. And so he came in to 7 yards, and, you know, that setup was good as close as it was. Again, it just didn't work out. You know, it's just, you know, when you get an animal in that close and you don't get a clear shot, it just,
yeah,
it really sucks.
Talk to us a little bit about like your strategy, you know, like hunting solo and incorporating the decoy. Obviously when you're hunting with a partner, you have the luxury of, you know, them dropping back, calling, you know, maybe moving the decoy around a little bit. What do you do kind of more in a scenario, and what's your optimal kind of setup for hunting solo with a decoy and trying to call one in?
Well, I had it in the bow mount.
Got it.
So that's basically how I did it. I had the decoy and I'd call, and sometimes I would move ahead. When I would call, I'd call and then I'd move 20 or 30 yards ahead when I could. I mean, you know, the deadfalls and stuff with the beetle kill, it's hard to move. And plus it was really dry. But when I felt like I was kind of in that area where I needed to be, I'd really lay down a good calling sequence, get him to respond. And then I would move up 20 yards.
Got it.
And then I would sit there and wait. And then if I knew that there, like on this bull, you know, I knew he was coming, and so I didn't have to move up anymore and he could see me. So, you know, that all kind of played out really well. But I just still couldn't get a clear shot. And then by the time, you know, he had come so close, he had gotten past my background. And so I was sticking out. And so he knew, oh, this isn't right.
Yeah.
So he took off, you know. And then, so that was a day I was basically following bugles all the way until like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So from the time I got out of the tent, basically, and up on the mountain, I was into elk up until late in the afternoon. And then that night, I was lucky enough, I think it was that night, we got a little rain, and then there was another guy that is from a town here locally that I know had the same tag, and they weren't having any luck. They were kind of having the same luck. You know, they were struggling as well, and I think they were getting a little frustrated. I said, well, you know what? You're welcome to hunt with me. I'm probably going to hunt Friday. It's going to be my last day. I'll probably wake up on Saturday and head home. And they said, well, why don't you stick it out till Saturday afternoon? We're going to stay until Saturday afternoon. I said, that's fine. If you guys want to meet me at my camp, that's fine. So, so I got back to my camp. The afternoons, just there was a lot of wind. And in the afternoons, it seemed like the wind really picked up. And there was, we had not had any action in the afternoon. It was really slow. So,
and this is the second to last day or the last day?
This is the second, it's the Thursday, the second to the last day I was there, basically. And so Sunday was the last day of the season. And I said, well, we'll get up here on this mountain, beat everybody up there. I mean, cause there was a little bit of activity again, some new, a new influx of a handful of people. And I said, we're just gonna have to get up early, get to the gate. And then, you know, get up this logging road, you know, before anybody gets up there. And there were times when I would see people there and we would talk about where we were going. I mean, I think that's a respectful thing to do, you know, like, which way are you headed? Well, we're going to go this direction. I said, okay, that's fine. I'm going to go this way. Sounds good. Good luck to you. You know, it wasn't like, okay, asshole, that's where I'm going. You know, it's like, okay, you know, cool. All right. We're going to head this direction then. You know, good luck. And because, hey, when you have a tag like that and you've been waiting a long time, you kind of want everybody to get one. You're pulling for everybody, really.
Exactly.
And so the last day, the last morning we got up and the activity was pretty slow. We seen elk right away again, just like the last three or four mornings going up there. Followed a herd again, lost them. Because the bugling was just not, they weren't as active, and so it wasn't as easy for us to kind of navigate through all the deadfalls quickly. And so we were just kind of holed up, waiting for the wind to kind of, you know, get more consistent up slope. So about 9 o'clock, usually the wind kind of starts getting funny. And that's usually a good time to not do anything.
Yeah.
And so that's what we did. We took a little nap and I woke up pissed. I kind of took a, you know, a pretty good hard mountain nap and I woke up and I was just kind of pissed off. I was like,
reality starts to sink in at that point, right? I mean, like
yes,
you're 15 years
like,
in.
You know, hey, it's about done. And so I reached in my pack, grabbed my sandwich and looked at the guy that was with me. And I said, I'm not going to say what I said, but I basically said, we got to find an elk and we got to kill one. That's just it. And the wind was not like, super consistent, but it was always kind of going up, never going down, but mostly up.
Yep.
And I said, let's gain some elevation. Let's find it. And I'm going to bugle and we're going to walk this entire mountain until we find an elk to respond and we're going to kill him. And so we gained about 100 feet of elevation and we walked a quarter mile and I let out a lazy bugle and boom, one lit up right away. And it's funny, I'm going to stop with my story right now. My brother, and I know that people that call that, you know, that are good at calling elk, they talk about being able to put emotion into your calls.
Yeah.
And maybe my emotional state was reflected in my calling at that point. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that elk bugled. I walked down. We walked 100 yards down the slope. He bugled again. And I bugled right in his face about the best screaming bugle I could possibly do. And then the guy instinctively behind me, and he wasn't going to shoot one. To his credit, I'd been hunting this mountain for several days. He wasn't going to go and shoot a bull on the mountain that I've been hunting on, and you know, unless we just happened to be able to shoot two of them at a time.
Yeah.
You know, and he goes, this is yours. Let's, you know, and so he started raking the trees behind me. Not the bull, the guy I was with. And again, I hear a bunch of limbs and sticks popping, and I'm going like, well, scared another herd away. and so there was just this eerie moment, awkward moment of silence there, just kind of waiting for something to happen. And I motioned to Jimmy, and I said to start raking the tree again. So he starts raking this tree. He sounded great, by the way. And down the slope, here that bull comes, and I ranged a stump at 50 yards because he was kind of tracking on up, and he was coming fast. So there really was not a whole lot of time. I drew my bow back before he got to that stump, and when he got to that stump, he just turned right at me. And it was just like an announcer at a football game. 45-40, 35-30. Once he got to 25, I started getting a little pissed off because his face, his head was covering, his front of his chest, and he was coming, and I was trying to talk him into raising his head, and he kept coming closer. He was inside of 20, and he finally took a small step to the right, and he raised his head, and my arrow, all I remember is seeing my arrow in his bury in his front of his chest.
Wow.
I just instinctively had followed him, and I knew where my arrow needed to be. On those quartering two shots with the decoys, and when they're on their bow, and I did not have the decoy on my bow. But like for whitetails and mule deer and some other stuff, we get a lot of quartering two shots because in the open, when we're either having a person hold it or we got it on the bow mount, we get a lot of shots that are frontal or quartering two at close range. And so I just burn a hole right through their body to where I want my arrow to exit. And then my pin just kind of naturally finds its spot on the body. And it was in him and buried to the fletching before I knew it. And it was, I think he only made it 35 or 40 yards from where I shot him. And I was one relieved camper. You know, he wasn't a giant bull, but I tell you, I would shoot that bull every single day I go to Colorado. I'd never pass him up.
Oh, yeah. That's a sweet bull. Any public land, doesn't matter if it's draw or over the counter. That's an awesome public land bull. Any elk with a bow, cow, spike, whatever. Yeah. But, you know, to shoot a bull like that, that's definitely a feat.
Yeah. And I was considering shooting a cow, too. I said, well, if I get a chance to shoot a cow close, I'm going to do it because I'm not going home without meat. And I want to punch a tag. And it just kind of, one of the buddies of mine that was with me, he goes, man, it's going to be a lot. He goes, Garrett, if you keep sticking with it, it's just going to be one of those times where it's like, man, this sucks. It sucks. It sucks. Man, what's going on? This sucks. And then the next thing you know, it's going to be, man, that was easy. And that was just exactly how it was. It was like, man, it sucked for so long. And then all of a sudden it was just like, man, that was pretty easy.
That was textbook.
Yes, it was textbook. And that's how I wanted to kill one. I mean, that is truly how. And this hunt was 10% about heads up decoy and 90% about the 15 years and about a personal goal of mine to go and shoot an elk basically by myself.
Yeah.
So it all kind of worked out exactly how it was supposed to. And I was very fortunate, and I'm really happy that that's how it all turned out. I learned a ton. I mean, I look back on every day that we hunted and the experience. I learned a lot about elk hunting because I've seen a bunch of them. I feel more comfortable hunting them. I'm not as intimidated as with the mountains as I was when I first started elk hunting. I feel a lot more comfortable. I feel a lot more comfortable, predicting what the wind's going to do, getting the wind in your favor, and that just all comes with not giving up.
Yeah. Yeah. You learn a hell of a lot more from the blown opportunities and the close calls and the encounters than you do of the actual success, right? Because like what you just explained, he came in on a string, he did exactly what he was supposed to, and it felt like it was easy. But the
right
15 other encounters that you had, it's like nothing would fall into place. And that's where you really kind of learn about the wind, you know, where you need to be in position, all the above. And I felt like you kind of experienced every realm of elk hunting with this trip.
You bet. I mean, it wouldn't, I'm so glad that I didn't shoot that one the first 45 minutes in.
Yeah.
Cause that's, I mean, you don't pass up opportunities, Adam.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't, but I'm really glad that that's not how it went down.
For sure. For sure.
And yeah. You know, I'm so, yeah.
Got the full package there. And then you have a couple people with you to be able to help pack this thing out. How was the, how was it getting it off the mountain?
It was not hard at all. I mean, we weren't in the mountain was, I don't even know how you explain it. It was straight up and down on the sides, but then on top it was flat. So there was a nice closed logging road that we took for a mile up, and we gained all of our elevation on that logging road, except for about 300 feet. So then from the time we jumped off of the logging road up to the top of the mountain, you know, we gained about 300 feet there, and then it was pretty easy getting around, except for all the deadfalls. And you know what I'm talking about.
Brutal.
To go a mile in dark timber, you got to walk three.
Yeah.
You know, just to get around all the deadfalls or to go over them. I mean, sometimes you just ultimately have to go over them. You can't get around anything. And so, you know, so. They always seem to be up on top and kind of on easy slopes, fairly easy slopes. We never got to where the mountain was like straight up and down. And we knew that if we did, you know, we were in trouble. So luckily the elk kind of cooperated. There were lots of shady places and lots of tall grass behind, you know, where they were bedded. So the pack out was not bad at all. I was pretty happy with how all that went down. It's still tiring. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, trekking poles are, I think, a moral imperative and a good pack that can stabilize your meat so it's not bouncing around on your back, whatever pack that might be. But, you know, going over all those deadfalls and some of the rocks, yeah, I think you got to have a trekking poles, at least one.
Yeah.
And the guy that was with me, you know, bless his heart, helped me pack it out. We quartered him, bagged him up, and then we, you know, I had a pack that would carry meat from the kill to, you know, to my other meat hauling pack. And I gave him a trekking pole, and he didn't realize how big a deal a trekking pole was until he had one in his hand and started carrying meat. And he's like, man, I'm glad I had a pole.
Yeah, it makes
a big
difference.
It just helps you get over those. Yeah, just, you know, you're not going to be able to walk around every deadfall. Or when you're going down a slope, you know, you need to be able to reach out so you don't slide down. You know, so, but the pack out was you know, fine. We did our justice with the meat. We got, you know, two big coolers full of meat and I'm happy with that. You know, elk meat is everybody. I mean,
you gotta love that.
The backstrap off that thing, I'm like, oh my God, I cannot wait to start eating this thing. And my mouth is watering right there. So great. You know, and we got the last, we left part of it, and got it at first thing Saturday morning and stuck it on ice and finished breaking camp and headed home with a big smile on my face. And then, you know, there's not a lot of things. I'm a fairly humble guy. You know me really well, Adam. But I've always wanted to drive down the interstate with a big rack, elk rack in the back of my truck.
You get all sorts of good looks.
Yeah, I've seen thousands of people do it. I'm going, man, you know, I just want to one day drive down I-70 back home with a big elk in the back of my truck, you know, so everybody sees it, right?
Yep.
Well, I get to Oakley, Kansas, where I get onto I-70, and it's dark. I was pissed. So I was like, you know, I'm just going to leave it here and just drive, get up in the morning and drive to Oakley and back.
Showboat a little bit.
Awful, but yeah, I know that sounds awful, but
I don't blame you there. That's hilarious.
Dang it, man. Like, I've all these people I see driving down the interstate with elk in the back of their vehicle, I gotta drive home in the dark.
That's too funny. That's too funny. That reminds me of a story. I came when I killed my buck on public land in 2015. I had it skull capped. You know, and I had it had it in my front seat. Like, I was so proud of this deer that I had the antler sitting in my front seat, belt buckled on the passenger side. And I had these two guys like pull up alongside of me as I'm going 70 down the highway. And they're just like looking at me and give me the thumbs up. And they're like doing the archery, you know, like drawing back a bow. Did you get it with a bow? And I'm like, yeah. And we basically had this 30-second conversation going down the highway, you know, just visuals. But it was, I was like, man, that was pretty cool, because I'd never been able to experience that before. And a couple guys were pretty impressed with it, so it was fun.
yeah, it's fun. I mean, you know, I kind of do the same thing when I drive by people, I pass people on the interstate, or they pass, you know, and I see, I always give them the thumbs up, because elk are hard to get, you know.
Oh yeah,
there are guys out there that have it down to a science, and I applaud them and I envy them for sure. And you know, I'm not an expert elk hunter. I never will be. I'd love to do it. They're cool animals. I mean, when they're laying there, you just don't have an idea how, if you've never elk hunted, you got to do it. You have to hear an elk bugle in the wild. I think if you bow hunt, you've got to experience that, because you will feel alive. You are in the wild. I mean, it is one of the coolest noises, sounds in nature that there is a wild elk, bull elk bugling in the wild. It's just, you can't explain it, you know?
That's what it's all about.
It is. And you know, and then when you see them and you're in them and you start and you're near them, their size, and they're a cool animal. There's no doubt about it. You know, the people that hunt them, chase them every year and have success, they know that. And for the people that have never hunted and they dream about it, you just have to do it. You've got to just say, I'm going. There's so much information out there now and tools and techniques to help you be successful now. I mean, look at all the things you put out. I mean, the information and the learning curve is so much different now than it was 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago. You know, you can go out and have a pretty good idea what you're in for, except for the physical and the mental game. That's the only thing you can't learn at home.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. And that's a huge part to it. I mean, you know, if you're serious about bow hunting, if you love to hunt, I mean, it's one of those things that you have to do. And like I said, you just got to take the leap of faith and get a buddy or two and go for it. And it'll be the experience of a lifetime for sure.
And, you know, and when I first, like back in 2005 or 2003 or something like that, I just decided I was going. And, you know, at that time, the mountain scared me to death. I didn't trust any of my equipment or myself. And so I had to have somebody with me. Now, I feel much more comfortable just going to the mountains and spending some time in there, even if it's fly fishing or whatever, and you've got an idea that you're going to end up having to go by yourself. Not being intimidated by the mountains is probably the number one thing.
Yep.
Knowing you're stepping foot. I mean, you can get anywhere on a map. until you get to where the map tells you you need to be and you realize, holy shit, I can't get up there. So, you know, you've got to go out there and look first. And then, you know, then you've got to make sure when you're there that you're in a, that your mind is right and that physically you've prepared a little bit so you're not you're able to get around.
For sure. What before we drop off here, Garrett, what's your whole take on the point, you know, creep and, you know, how long it took to get that tag? I mean, is it one of those things that you're going to keep putting in points and maybe try to get another tag that's 10, 15 points? Or are you going to, you know, maybe do a couple years and then try to put in for one of those draw units? Like, was it worth it, you know, to wait that long? I mean, obviously you killed a great bull and everything, but like kind of what's your standpoint on that? Is it something that you want to pursue again and wait that long, or do you want to shoot for something a little less?
I'm going to shoot for something less. I probably won't ever do that again.
It's a long time.
It's a long time. You know, I don't know. I'm not Mr. Colorado Division of Wildlife draw result guy. I just know that when there's not a random component and it's purely, you know, guys with the most points get the draw. I think that's why I like Arizona so much, because you get an incredible hunt down there, and it's not, if you want a lifetime commitment to a certain area, that's your own choice, but yep. You can go on some great elk hunts in a great area, a great place, you know, for less than 15 years. I mean, I hunted Arizona twice before I drew this tag, and the hunts, the two units that I drew in Arizona, are one of them I know had bigger elk and a lot of elk. And the other unit where I ended up killing one had a lot of elk, maybe not and probably as far as the size wise, the equivalent. And wow. You know, those are things you could do every 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And so, and then in this unit that I hunted in, it is not something, I mean, you need to be in pretty damn good shape. It is a rugged ass unit. It's not a piece of cake. I mean, we were hunting 11,000 feet and up every day.
Wow.
And yeah, so it's not an easy unit to hunt as far as the terrain. You know, so I'm glad it worked out how it did. Had I not killed one, I might have had a different opinion. you know, because I mean, when you invest that much time into something, you want to come back with a tag punched, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky to have that, you know, to have it all go down like that. But I think 15 years is an awful long time to wait to go to a place, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah.
Now, if you've got a place that you're shooting giant elk in an over-the-counter unit, then, you know, okay, who cares, you know?
Yeah.
But most people don't have that luxury.
Makes sense. Well, cool. Well, so, that's an awesome story, Garrett. You know, great kind of whole, you know, the whole season, the whole walkthrough of everything, the planning, the preparation, doing it by yourself, getting it done, and, you know, coming home with a punch tag. That's a great story. So really appreciate you coming on, and we'll have to have you back on at some point here again to talk some more hunting if you're up for it.
You betcha. You know, we're going to whitetail hunting is going to start kicking in here pretty soon. And, you know, and obviously I'm a lot more confident in that, setting than I am in the mountains, but, I have a lot more stories, obviously, because I'm in whitetails a lot more. They're a lot more prolific around here. So, if we could talk about that, that'd be cool. Cause I'm sure we'll have some stories.
For sure. Well, cool. Well, thanks again, Garrett, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks, Adam, for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. And there we go. Another episode down. Thanks again for tuning in. Thanks again to Garrett Rowe for coming on the podcast. That was a great story, a great hunt. And, you know, it's something about staying out there and staying determined. He went home, you know, regrouped and came back and got it done on the final days of his hunt. And you know, if that's a theme that I'm seeing, you know, for my own hunts and as well as, you know, the people that I've had on the podcast recently, grind it out the last couple of days, you know, grind it out and good things will come your way. If you keep at it, if you stay positive, things will happen. And that's so common among many hunts. It's at least for me. I mean, it never works out on the first day or the second day. I'm always one of those guys who just dreams of, you know, tagging out on the first couple of days and then, you know, getting to kind of take it easy or kill a doe or, you know, relax at hunting camp for a day, God forbid. But I'm one of those guys that has to grind it out to the very end. But again, hats off to Garrett. And, you know, Heads Up Decoy is one of the sponsors of the podcast. So definitely check them out. Headsupdecoy.com. If you're getting ready for whitetail season, definitely pick up a buck decoy or a doe decoy. It changes the game for sure. So, yeah, thanks again for tuning in. If you haven't done so, definitely go to sportsmansnation.com. You could subscribe there. You can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. And leave us that review. Leave us that 5-star review. It'd be much, much appreciated. Check out Sportsman's Nation on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube. They got a channel going there. Also, a good blog going on, too. Lots of good content coming out on sportsmansnation.com as well from the blog side. And then, as always, go to transitionwild.com. I still have the Colorado Beginner Elk Hunting Guide as the free download right now. Still plenty of rifle seasons left in Colorado. You got second, third, and fourth. So if you're looking to take that first elk hunt in Colorado, make sure you check that out. Definitely go do that. You're going to learn about scouting, you know, planning your hunt, where to hunt, when to hunt, and all the above. And most importantly, some further inspiration to get your ass out there and kill something, because I sure can't. So I got to have you do it for me. Anyways, that's it. I appreciate you. Love you. Thanks for tuning in. Get out there and hunt. And we'll talk to you soon.